All right. Let me start by apologizing for the fact that there were some broken links that I've now fixed on the web page. In particular, the link to the second of the readings on Jewish law, which you're going to be doing pretty shortly, somebody pointed out didn't work, and I believe I've now fixed it. I may talk about that a little bit more later, and some other links as well. So, as usual, let me start by asking whether you have any questions on the stuff that we did last week. And if you don't speak up quickly, then the next question is, do you have any questions on the reading for this week, the chapter on the Amish, the reading for today? And, yes?
Just kind of a general question, you might get to there. But it seems that the Amish are much more forgiving and...
Much more.
...forgiving as a
yes.
So the threat of being excommunicated was their largest deterrent, and still seems to work as effectively as the Gypsies. How do you explain that?
Yeah, that whole contrast is interesting. Because in some ways it looks rather similar between the two groups, and in other ways very different. They're strong on forgiveness. They're strong on humility. I don't remember if I mentioned it in the chapter, but low in Amish terminology is a positive term. So that a lower Amish affiliation means one with stricter rules, and a higher one, I mean, they're a little bit soft on, you know, some of the issues, so to speak. But I guess the question of why the Amish work, it seems to me, is one of the central questions. And I guess the answer might be because it really is better to be in than out. I mean, I think that's what they would say, that yes, they will forgive you, but they forgive you only if you're willing to confess your sins and stop committing them. And if you keep on committing them, you're out. So, other points that occurred to people about the... Yes?
I just had a question, kind of clarification. In one part of the chapter, they were talking about how if one spouse is shunned, they might request excommunication. Would that be just for the shunned spouse, or would that be for the couple so that they could...
Well, if one of them is shunned, then the other one asks to be shunned as well.
Okay.
In order that they can eat at the same table, sleep together, and so forth.
I was just wondering if one's shunning, I guess,
is excommunication. Yeah.
So if one of them's excommunicated, the other one would ask to be that way as well. Okay.
Yeah, that's apparently a not uncommon pattern. Yeah, that in a sense you yeah.
Chapter talks a lot about punishments for doing things against the Amish kind of religious rules. But I'm wondering to what extent the Amish law is set up to deal with more serious crimes, like murder or rape or something like that.
Yeah.
Or do those same rules apply to those more serious crimes?
The Amish will not report serious crimes to the authorities. That's the normal policy. I'm sure there are exceptions. But the normal policy is the Amish do not believe in criminal justice system. And therefore, that if you rob an Amish, the normal response is that you're not called police.
So as long as you go through the forgiveness steps...
You can be a non-Amish. You could be a non-Amish who robs them, and they won't call the cops. That's my understanding, at least, of what the normal law is, that they disapprove of the whole system of punishing people for crimes. So, yeah. I mean, in an odd sense, we haven't gotten to the Chinese yet, but in an odd sense, they're sort of more Confucian than the Confucians, in that the sort of original Confucian position, as far as one can tell, was against criminal punishment and saying that, you know, you inspire people by the ruler being an example of virtue and so forth. Although by the time Confucians were actually running a system, they've backed quite a long distance away from that. But their view, as far as I can tell, is that you aren't supposed to punish people. You're supposed to, I guess, persuade them, work with their hearts, and so forth. That as far as I can tell is their position. Now, I presume that some of those crimes committed by an Amish would result in their sanctions and would eventually result in my doom, depending on what you did and so forth. And that as far as I can tell, there are some offenses serious enough so that rather than being told, please stop this, or you will be ostracized, you get ostracized. You still have the option of coming back if you're willing to, you know, repent, in effect. languages. It seems to be the logic of the system, as I understand. Yeah. Other questions, comments?
Yes. So along those lines, what would you do if there was a kind of a intentional, continuous fashion, a series of problems?
Don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, presumably they're allowed to lock their doors. They're generally nonviolent, so I don't know if they would be willing to actually use force against a robber or not. I'm reminded of the joke about the Quaker who comes down one night to find, with his crusty blunderbuss, to find a burglar rifling through his silver cabinet, and he points to a blunderbuss of the burglar and says, "Friend, I wouldst not harm thee for this vile world and all that is in it, but thou standest where I am about to shoot." And the burglar leaves. That's a rich problem. In a sense, it's a problem for anyone who believes in nonviolence, right? A problem for pacifists. What do you do if your country is attacked? But as far as they can tell, they are consistent pacifists. And so I presume that if there was a series of robberies, they would try to survive in spite of it. And if they could, that is, if the robber was Amish, he would only get Maidun. And other than that, I guess, you know, try to lock your door and try to see if you can persuade him to be good. Yeah.
Do you know if they recognize the doors?
I think they do, but I am not certain. I think they do. They're coming out of European Protestantism, so there's no particular reason why they wouldn't. But the answer is I'd really have to, you know, look through the sources to see if there's any discussion of that issue. My impression is that it's pretty uncommon. That is, the impression you get is of sort of a traditional family pattern where people normally remain married for life. But I don't know if they have to. I don't think they do, but I'm not sure. Yeah.
How do bishops, once that's away, what usually happens, not just like formally, but also, because you think of like a critical man, there could be somebody in this room.
What's happening, as I understand it, is the new bishop is selected. You've got, I think, four clergy, a bishop, I don't remember, a bishop, two of something else, and I think either one or two of another level. I forget the names of them. And the new bishop is chosen from the other clergymen. And I think it's entirely random, though I am not certain. That is, the initial procedure for choosing clergy is that you have a secret nomination process in which people go, I'm not sure if they whisper or handle a piece of paper or what, but there's somebody nominating people. And depending on the affiliation, I think it's either two or three nominations and you're one of the possibilities. And they then have a random position or a random process for deciding among those nominated who get to be clergy. And there is another random process for choosing among the clergy for the bishop. And I don't think that there's a second round of nominations, but I'm not certain about that. But the theory is that God is deciding. Yeah?
So you mentioned in the chapter that the whole system resembles a competitive market for legal rules.
That's one way of looking at it, yeah.
So how is the, I guess, mobility between the different congregations and the different omniscience?
As far as I can tell, the only real restriction on mobility is geographical. That is to say, if you're in Lancaster, there is only one affiliation in Lancaster of at least Old Order Amish. Lots of congregations, but they're all similar enough so they consider themselves a single affiliation. So if you not only didn't like, I think the situation is if you didn't like your congregation, you would probably have to trade farms with somebody or to buy some land and move, because I think that in Lancaster, the individual congregations are geographical. But that in some other areas, especially if you've got several affiliations in the same area, they're overlapping. So you could, to some degree, simply say, well, I no longer remember that congregation, I'd like to remember that one. And I haven't seen any real discussion of admission of people to a congregation except for the question of people who have been shunned by another congregation. And I think the view of the lower, that is the more extreme Amish congregations, is that you should not admit somebody who has been shunned by his congregation unless he has first made peace with his congregation. As I understand their view, it is that if you get maidum from your congregation and you then go to a less strict congregation and say, I'd like to join you, the stricter ones believe that they shouldn't let you join, although I think that's not the case of the less strict ones. That their view is you should first go back to your own congregation, confess your sins, be forgiven in effect, and then you can go join a less strict one. That seemed to be the situation. But the impression, at least, that I get, also as far as I can tell, there's nothing to keep people from starting new congregations. That it sounds as though it usually happens when the number of families gets too large, but that isn't entirely clear. The other couple of things that I was going to mention, because I may have had them in the footnotes, but I don't think I had them in the chapter. One of them is the question of language, that the Amish have their own languages. There are two of them, actually. The more common one is what's called Pennsylvania Dutch. And Pennsylvania Dutch is a German dialect that developed in the U.S. That is a dialect that developed among several different German-speaking populations of immigrants. The later immigrants came from, I think, somewhere in Switzerland, and their home language is a variant of Schweizdeutsch, so Swiss German, and is not the same. In addition to that, the Amish, their religious documents are written in what I think was the ordinary, you know, academic German of whatever, the 17th or 18th century, whenever they were composed. So the result is that an ordinary Amish is fluent in at least two languages, and at least his home language is going to be some kind of a German dialect and English, and may also read another dialect of German, which is sort of interesting in terms of sort of connecting in with the whole question of education. The fact that they have an educational system which is compulsory, that really exists only through eighth grade. It is an educational system where in practice the teachers have only gotten eighth grade education. All right, they don't have education degrees because they almost don't go to college. They don't have high school because they don't normally go to high school. And yet it produces people who apparently are fluent in two different languages who appear to make, you know, successful life results as far as you can tell, which is, you know, some evidence that, that maybe they're doing something right. And they're doing it in sort of one-room schoolhouses with one or two-room schoolhouses with mixed-age groups. It very much sort of feels like the descriptions you see of rural schoolhouses 150 years ago, and yet seems to function tolerably well. I think one of the rules is that in school they have to speak English. They're speaking the Pennsylvania Dutch normally at home. And one of the things you come across that's sort of interesting in the books on the Amish is the question of moving out of farming. That basically the traditional Amish activity was mainly farming. And the claim is made that the pattern that's been happening, and it's happening in Lancaster to some extent and other places, has been developing other things. So a lot of it, especially in Lancaster, is essentially small-scale entrepreneurial activity, making Amish furniture, making buggies, doing not all of it aimed at Amish things, although some of it's aimed at the ordinary market. Pretty clearly, they don't like having big firms with a lot of employees. So you're talking about, you know, a firm with, that's what they, 10, 12 employees. They do not object to power tools. It's sort of interesting. The standard Amish factory is using a technology which I think went out of common use maybe in the 1920s or so, which is that you have a shaft powered by a motor, maybe a diesel motor, I'm not sure, and then belts from that shaft coming down to power the individual power tools. That they don't like electric, separately powered electric tools as a rule, but they are willing to use power tools based on a different technology. So they seem to be very successful as far as you can tell in that, which again is evidence that they seem to be doing a tolerable job of educating their people, even though they break all of our rules to do it. Now, in other parts of the country, you had, I think in Indiana, I think is the one place where you've got Amish working in non-Amish factories as employees, typically as groups of Amish together. But you've also got in some areas a pattern where the Amish are engaged in construction work. And where typically you have a non-Amish who owns a vehicle, and then a team of Amish who he transports. So he's sort of acting as the interface between them and the rest of the world. Amish in general do not object to traveling in motor vehicles. It's apparently pretty common. One of the things that happens is that you get sort of colonies in the sense that you have an area like Lancaster where land is very expensive because it's the population has steadily grown for a long time. And so at some point as land gets expensive, especially because you're having families of six kids, so you're going to need each farm is going to have to turn into three farms, so to speak, on average. So one of the things you do is that a group of Amish from Lancaster go buy land in Kentucky or in southern Indiana where land is much cheaper, and you then have a new Amish community there, but it still has ties to the old community because that's where, there you neighborly one member of the family probably stayed and worked the family farm and the other two bought land somewhere else. So then when there's a wedding in Lancaster, they hire somebody, a non-Amish with a bus or something, to drive a whole bunch of them up from southern Indiana to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, to attend the wedding and whatever other festivities go on. And I think I mentioned the existence of what are called Amish taxi cabs, which are basically cars driven by non-Amish, which specialize in transporting Amish. So the question is, why aren't Amish supposed to own cars or drive cars? Theory? Yeah.
Probably because it would take them away from their society and increase the likelihood that they would join the English.
I think that's the right pattern. I wouldn't. You're taking it one step farther than I would, though you may be right. I would have said that part of the logic of what they're doing, I think, is that they have constructed a society where most social interaction is within the society, where you are not only mostly interacting with other Amish, but interacting with other members of your congregation, maybe a few nearby congregations. And you can see that a automobile is going to subvert that because it's going to make it easier to have friends who are 20 miles away or 15 miles away, and you then have a much looser social network. And if they think that a tight social network where everybody who knows each other kind of thing works better, then it makes some sense.
Well, if you look at family, friends, and how things operate in our society these days, everyone's always on vacation or gone, and it's not as closely knit, so it does kind of tend to isolate people a little bit more from the community.
Yeah. Well, I'm reminded a little of my experience when I was a graduate student. There was a couple that were friends of mine who were Orthodox Jews. And the nice thing about it was that I knew that if I wanted to visit them, if I wasn't doing anything on a Saturday, all I had to do was walk over to their apartment, and they were almost certainly going to be there. And I couldn't call before I came because they wouldn't answer the phone because it was Saturday. And that was sort of pleasant in a way, sort of in terms of a kind of a relaxed, informal socializing pattern. But yeah, that's part of what's intriguing. It's hard to know, of course, how much of what's going on really makes functional sense and how much is tradition, as it were. Yep.
Well, the car thing, the Amish are very much a culture of humility, right? So owning a car isn't really just a mode of transportation, it can also be a status symbol. Especially like when cars first were invented, it was very much so more of a status symbol. So it seems like maybe that might be why they
could be.
Never owned cars.
That could be, although presumably a nice buggy will have to serve some similar function. I don't know how expensive buggies are. That's what they normally use, are horse-drawn wagons. And in fact, one of the sources of friction that still exists has to do with the question of safety of buggies, that there are various state laws about how slow-moving vehicles have to be marked. And some of the lower Amish congregations take the position that some of those markings are sort of gaudy display that they disapprove of. And so there's therefore been various compromises and agreements on, do you have flashing lights on the back of your buggy and that sort of thing. I think it depends on the particular affiliation, but there have been places where there's been real friction over that. Other comments? Questions? Yes.
This is looking very good. And I'm giving my feedback. Part of their confession was you say that Christ is back in the sins, which implies that breaking the rules is a form of a sin. So they consider that to actually be like an actual sin.
But remember that these are rules you've sworn to keep.
So it's a breaking of oath.
I think so. That is, there was the point which I think I quoted the chapter of somebody saying basically when a young Amish is deciding whether to swear into the ordinu, remember that not swearing is better than swearing and breaking your oath. And if you think about the fact that they all take it for granted that different congregations will have different ordinances, well, you would sort of think at the first glance, you would say, well, that means aren't the others heretics? And yet that doesn't seem to be the feel at all. So I think it's much more that in an odd way, that reminds me of the Islamic situation where you've got the four mutually orthodox schools of law. And what's going on, I think, is that all of the Islamic schools of law take the position that our knowledge of law is only probabilistic. There's some exceptions. There are some things they claim are certain. But as a general rule, God's law is certain. Our deduction of God's law is not certain. Well, I may think you made a mistake in your deduction of God's law, but that's not really the same as your choosing to defy God's law. And I think, similarly, my impression is that, and after all, because the ordinum changes. I mean, how could it be, if it was really a matter of it's a sin to do this, how could it be, well, it was a sin last year, but it isn't a sin this year? So I think it looks much more as though the real moral sanction is the fact you promised to do it, and that then they are trying to sort of fine-tune their rules continuously, you know, year by year, to achieve their objectives. On the other hand, my guess is that not all of the rules could be explained as functional in this way. So if you think about the question of tractors, all right, the rule which says that you can have a tractor with metal wheels but not rubber wheels, on the grounds that apparently metal wheels work in the field but don't work on the road, makes some sense because once it has rubber wheels, it starts moving towards being like a car. But why not have, what about the stricter ones that don't have tractors at all? And it's a little unclear to me why using powered equipment in your own farm would undercut that social system. Maybe I'm missing something, but. So it might be that what's going on is that rule originates maybe when tractors are new and they're thought of as, I don't know, showing off or something else. But then it really just becomes in sort of a marker of our society kind of thing. I mean, my general instinct in all of these is to try to think up reasons for, yeah.
Possible reason that may be a big part of it, I'm not sure, but to keep the simplicity that Christ lived with, basically doing everything by hand.
But they don't do everything by hand.
Wouldn't the lower Amish communities basically have a more firm belief in Christ, therefore have less.
I don't know. It's an interesting idea, and I just don't know how much. They're clearly in favor of humility. I'm not sure to what extent simplicity. If you think of sort of 19th century technology, it wasn't particularly simple, right? I mean, arguably, a tractor is easier to get along with than a mule. I've seen the comment made in the 70s of people writing fantasy that moderns think of horses as if they were sort of like motorcycles. You know, you turn them on and you turn them off. And that, in fact, horses require a whole lot more attention to being living creatures. And, you know, you do the wrong things and the horse dies or it gets sick or things of that sort. So I wonder whether their agricultural technology is really simpler than the more modern technology. But my impression is at least a lot of them certainly are willing to use. I mean, some of them use powered hay balers on top of their horse-drawn wagons, for example, which seems sort of hot. Yeah.
Amish that are able to ride bicycles?
I would have thought that they would be able to, but I don't actually know.
They do.
They do?
Yeah, like kids and stuff.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything suggesting they couldn't, so. Yeah. Yeah.
You touched on their system of dating, where they bring their sister and bring the date with them and bring the girlfriend.
Yeah.
So is that, are they doing premarital sex?
Don't know. An interesting question. I think that some but not all do some version of bundling, meaning sharing a bed, but it's not clear whether they're having sex or whether they're just, you know, petting and necking and things of that sort. But my impression is that in some but not all congregations, it is an accepted kind of thing that, I'm trying to remember, I've seen details, and I think it basically involves the guy going to the woman's house at night and being let in by her, and then spending the night with her in bed and then going off again. And I think I've seen that described. You see references to bundling in American colonial practice as well. And you then, you know, it's hard to know what's coming out of that. And I don't know whether they have a rule against contraception or not. That is, given the family sizes, they probably aren't using contraception normally in a marital context. One of the things I've wondered about, it's a distance from the Amish, but a general issue, is how effective pre-modern forms of contraception were. That if you think of things like coitus interruptus, which shows up in the Bible and people have known ever since, because the people who criticize the Catholic position on contraception often put it in terms of this results in countries being poor because families can't keep down the number of children. And the question is whether things like rhythm and interruptus, which are permitted, are adequate to have three kids instead of six, but not adequate to safely engage in sex, which they disapprove of, without a risk of getting pregnant. And I just don't know. Somebody must have data on the effectiveness of things like that. But sort of an interesting question in terms of how all of that interacts. I'm trying to remember, because I think I have seen some discussion about the question of premarital pregnancy, the obvious issue, but I don't remember what it said. But presumably, I mean, they believe in forgiveness, so presumably even if they did disapprove of it, that wouldn't really have very much long-term consequences. Yeah.
With the growing, I guess, prevalence of technology and everything in everyday life, regardless of like going to the store,
yeah.
Do you think that the online life is and their legal system is sustainable? Because eventually, aren't they basically using everything going to have some form of modern technology?
But they allow some forms of modern technology. It isn't like they have a ban on modern technology. They have bans on very specific ones. You know, the powered hay baler is modern technology. The policy with telephones, depending on the congregation, but at least the higher congregations, you can have a telephone in your business office if it's not in your house. You can use the telephone of a non-Amish neighbor. You can have a telephone in a separate small structure being shared by several households. So the rules seem to be set up so that you don't have the option of the sort of stereotypical teenager spending an hour and a half on the phone with friends. But you do have the option of being able to use it as a tool to call out when it's necessary to do something, you know, if you want to call the doctor for an emergency or something. So it seems to me that in general, their rules are nothing like as strong as forbidding modern technology. They do modern medicine, for example. It's only those forms of modern technology that for sort of traditional reasons they don't like, or those forms that they see as in some sense disruptive. And it's clear that there's a continual adjustment process, that is, that from the description in the chapter and the descriptions I read about it, you know, there's something which you're not supposed to do, so people start doing it. Nobody seems to object. So maybe in a year or two, the clergy decide, yeah, we should change the ordinary bit and allow this. Or maybe nobody objects, and after a year or two, the clergy says, that's a problem, it's causing some bad things to happen, we're going to start enforcing it now. So it doesn't look like a very rigid system, as far as you can tell. It looks like a system which is... And, you know, all you can say is that so far, they're winning. I mean, their population is doubling about every 20 years or so. So, you know, I think I gave the figure there, what, a quarter million now? Something like that, I think.
Yeah, 292,000.
Yeah, right. So that means, say, in 100 years, if that pattern keeps up, five doublings, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. All right, that would put them at 10 million. That would be the size of the state, a bit more than a state. Now, you know, it's hard to predict that anything will be stable for 100 years. But it relates to the general issue, incidentally, not particularly this course, which is, given that we have very reliable contraception, is the result going to be an evolutionary, either biological evolutionary or cultural evolutionary, push towards populations that like producing children? Right? If you think about
suppose there are some people who have a hardwired desire to have lots of kids. It's not clear that there are. Some of them disclosed there were. Well, if they're having, as the Amish are, six kids, and the rest of us are having one or two kids, in a while, most of the population is descended from those people. And, of course, it could be cultural with the Amish. It doesn't have to be genetic. The Amish, by the way, do have a genetic problem, and that is that they're quite an inbred population, with the result that there are some genetic, there are some heritable illnesses which are relatively common. I think dwarfism is fairly common, as I remember. I think there are some others that I've seen mentioned. And one result is also they don't have that many last names because of the whole inbred population. But there are some names that are very common. Other things? Yeah.
About the Rumspringa period,
yeah.
I saw a documentary years ago. I don't know how accurate it was, or if they were trying to just embellish it a little bit, but they really made it seem like, I mean, obviously they let the kids do kind of live a more free life and do things that are forbidden. But in this movie that I saw, they really made it seem like they could really do whatever they wanted, and they were kind of encouraged to get crazy more or less, like, more so than, like, when I saw this, I was still in high school, and I remember thinking, like, okay, I'm 17 or 18, and my parents would never let me do what these Amish parents are encouraging me kids to do. Like,
that doesn't sound like most of the scriptures I've seen.
Okay.
To begin with, it varies, again, across different affiliations. So the Rumspringa, I don't think, is a custom in all affiliations. But beyond that, the impression I get is that, if anything, it's a little milder than normal teen culture, in the sense that, to begin with, they're mostly doing with the other Amish kids, not very much mixing with non-Amish from the descriptions. And sort of being very bold and brave about it means buying a second-hand car and getting a driver's license and driving. And as far as I can tell, things like that, you're not supposed to tell your parents you're doing. So I don't think that the parents are encouraging them, but only the parents are going to turn a blind eye to things which they disapprove of, but which you haven't yet promised to abide by the ordinance, so you're not bound by it, as far as I can tell. And of course, one theory of it, I'm not sure it's right, is that this is a way of letting the kids see that the Amish life is better. That, you know, it's like the old argument that if you're worried about your kids eating chocolate, you have, you know, a whole box of candy, you let them eat it until they're sick, and then they won't. I don't think it works very well. But, yeah.
So, you mentioned they're inbreeding.
Yes.
Do they have any views on genetic testing?
It's a good question. Yeah. I don't know. That's interesting. That is, there is this sort of view that you're supposed to trust in God. So that part of the argument against Social Security was that was sort of not trusting God and your neighbor and your fellows take care of you. And I just don't know whether they would say, well, you know, God will make sure you don't, except that they know that you do have the problem that exists. So, yeah, there's somewhat similar cases you may know with Ashkenazi Jews, I think it's Tay-Sachs, is a hereditary disease. Disease is an odd term, it's not contagious, but it's hereditary, which is one of these things where if you're heterozygous, you don't have it, but if you're homozygous, you do. So two people, neither of whom shows it, but both of whom are carriers, can produce it, one child and four who does. And in that case, that community has set up elaborate mechanisms with basically sort of registries where you can, before you start dating the criminal, you can anonymously check and be told whether or not you are both Tay-Sachs carriers, in which case you go date somebody else. And that's a pretty conservative, Orthodox Jews are, in a sense, not as conservative, socially conservative, I guess, as the Amish, but it's not that. And that's one which is perfectly willing to do it. So I really don't know. It's a good question. If any of you find sources on it, let us know. Other things? All right, well, let me run through a few points. Yes?
The Amish must not be the only people that kind of restrict technology.
Mm-hmm.
So are there groups like that that you know of in other continents, countries? Maybe not.
There are no Amish on other continents. As far as I know, at this point, all of the Amish are either in the U.S. or Canada, and most of them are in the U.S. I understand. I'm just trying to think of whether there are other. That is, the Mennonites, don't know to what extent the Mennonites are the closest to the Amish. They're both from the same split off, the Anabaptists. And I just don't know enough about them to know.
how much. But I think there are some other, I'm trying to remember who, because I think there are other groups who engage largely in sort of traditional farming that I've seen described, but I don't remember what they are. But there are other Christian sects, and I don't know how they're doing, or elsewhere in the world. I think I've seen a science fiction story where one of these groups were used for colonizing a planet on the grounds that, you know, horses reproduce themselves and tractors don't. And therefore, it was a better system for getting started. But, you know, but it's really, of course, you could argue that the restriction of technology isn't limited to the Amish. That, after all, you've got a sizable movement against genetically engineered food in modern societies. And I think, though I am not sure, I think in Europe you actually have substantial legal restrictions on genetically engineered crops. And in the U.S. you don't, but you've got some pressure for it. There's been various controversy over whether a company that produces food has to tell you whether or not any of the ingredients are genetically engineered. And so that's, in a sense, an attempt to suppress technology. There's this whole idea of what's called the precautionary principle, which, as far as I can tell, is incoherent, but nonetheless a lot of people find it convincing, which says you shouldn't introduce something new unless you are absolutely certain that it couldn't have catastrophic results, roughly speaking. And the problem with that is that failing to introduce something might also have catastrophic results. So therefore you're in a situation where, in a sense, yeah?
Well, it's impossible to know what the effects of, you know, increasing is going to be until you actually do, you know.
Yeah.
I read a, the series wasn't very good, but it had a good concept. It's about an alien race, and there were like several associated races, and they sent like a scout to Earth in like the year 1200, and then, you know, their massive satellite ships were on their way at the time. You know, they got here, and then they got to Earth, you know, 700 years later. And because they're a very slow species that, you know, extensively, they extrapolate the possibility of introducing new technologies. They show up in 1940, and humans have technology and aircraft of their own, and after 20 years of war, ours is as good as theirs, and, you know, and then in the event we've achieved, you know, fast and light travel exceeding them, and, you know, it's a huge, yeah.
This may be a Turtle Dove series, a several volume Turtle Dove series. I read part of that. Yeah, there a number of science fiction authors have played with the idea of sort of the aliens invade us and we turn out to be smarter than they are in different versions. A certain amount of wishful fulfillment involved in it, but also sometimes entertaining stories. There's one I remember where the aliens have faster than light travel, but they have not invented machine guns or barbed wire, and therefore find themselves in serious difficulty when they try to conquer Earth. So that one is sort of funny. There was in a sequel where the humans and the aliens become allies, and sort of the humans are providing, you know, the sort of the troops for, you know.
I have one more question about that. Do you know why they wouldn't have any kind of formal education including becoming a clergy? Because presumably you would want to have
Well, it's not clear. That is, I think, for one thing, you can spend a whole lifetime reading the texts of your religion without having formal education. I think there are a number of different things going on. One of them, I think, is the humility business, that if you've gone through eighth grade and I've gone through college, I'm better than you are, and they wouldn't like that idea. But part of it also is that the non-Amish educational system is going to tend to acculturate them. So that I think it's pretty clear that part of the reason why they fought both compulsory education and public schooling was that once the public schools were large urban public schools rather than local one-room schoolhouses, they were afraid that their kids would get sort of infected by the mass culture that they didn't like, and they'd lose them. And that whole thing is an interesting issue. I've seen the same issue in a different context. My kids were homeschooled, and I think that when my daughter went away to college, she was really being dropped into an alien culture from her standpoint, that, you know, modern American teen culture just wasn't something she had any experience with. And it's sort of a complicated issue, because on the one hand, like the Amish, I think my culture is better. So in that sense, I'm in favor of having my kids see our family culture is the norm rather than the mass culture. On the other hand, there are all these people you'd like to be interacting with, and if they all feel like foreigners to you. And I can remember the same feeling when I was growing up. I wasn't homeschooled, but I still think that I much sort of thought of my family as normal people and the other kids at school as sort of, you know, aliens in some sense, relatively speaking. So it's, and that's one of the arguments over homeschooling, I think, at present, that one of the reasons to homeschool from any of a lot of different perspectives is because you don't really disapprove of the, you don't really approve of the culture that the local public school has. And the critics of homeschooling will say, sure, that means you don't want your kids to learn evolution. Whereas the other people say, no, I've got nothing against evolution. It's a bunch of other things in that culture that I don't like.
So it's kind of the idea of maintaining local culture, and that's why you don't have like an Amish institute or something,
or academy. Yeah, you could imagine the Amish having an Amish academy, except I think that would run into the humility problem. And it's not because you need to. That after all, you know, you can read, but they read. You can, if they want to learn Amish theology insofar as it exists, presumably they can read things written that cover that or anything else that they want. I think they use radio. I'm not sure if they use television or not. That's an interesting question. I'm not sure. I mean, that if you go back to the Gypsy case. Because some of these are the same problems as the Gypsies, right? The Gypsies don't want their kids to be acculturated either, and that's one reason why they try to keep them out of the public schools if they can. On the other hand, the Amish have succeeded because the Amish, in fact, are running their own school system under rules that nobody else could get away with in most states as to where they're Amish, as far as I can tell, whereas the Gypsies haven't. The Gypsies have to, I think, and I don't know what they do, but my guess is that a lot of the Gypsies just don't register their kids that they... in order to keep them out of the school system. That's a conjecture. I don't have data, but that's what I would do in their situation. Yeah.
So the National Amish Steering Committee,
yes.
Is that composed of Amish people?
Partly.
Oh, okay.
It's a mix of Amish and sort of pro-Amish, non-Amish people.
I see. So then do they have outside legal representation when they go into these high-profile Supreme Court cases?
They have I think largely volunteer lawyers who are mostly non-Amish. In fact, I suppose an Amish probably couldn't legally. Well, there might be states where you could in some way get around it, but it wouldn't be very practical to be an Amish member of the bar because, you know, just wondering whether somebody could get an eighth grade education and then practice. Yeah, and there probably are states where you could do it, but it would certainly not be the norm. Be fun if an Amish tried to sue on the grounds that it was religious discrimination not to let him into the bars. Because you suppose you have somebody who can in fact pass the bar exam. That would be an interesting case. Because they won that on the schooling, after all. I mean, the Wisconsin v. Yoder, I think, was the compulsory education case, and they won that 9-0, Supreme Court. So let me say a little bit about one of the issues that struck me reading about it, which has to do with stability, not stability against problems with technology, but stability against the problems of developing more centralized institutions. That if you think about the political structure, one way of looking at it is sort of the competitive market for rules. Another way is that it's really an anarchy. Another way is that it's the world's only social contract. That is to say, if you ask the question, why are people obliged to obey the law? That's not an easy question. I've just been reading a book by a philosopher who argues the answer is they're not. The Problem of Political Authority by Michael Humer, if anybody's curious. And he goes through a series of arguments offered by different philosophers. He's really asking two different related questions. One of them is, are governments entitled to do things that we would object to anybody else doing? So if you think about taxation, for example, if somebody says to you, I've decided that you need to have your lawn mowed, so I'm mowing your lawn and I'm taking $5 out of your wallet to pay myself for it. We would say that's clearly way outside the bound of permissible behavior. That's the way governments normally act. They collect tax, they provide you services, they collect taxes. You don't have the option of rejecting the services and not paying the taxes. So part of what Humer is asking is, can you make good philosophical arguments for doing that? And the other half is, can you make good philosophical arguments for saying you're obliged to obey the law even if the law is one that you wouldn't be obliged to obey if the law wasn't there. So that he would say, well, you're obliged not to murder people, but you would be obliged not to murder people even if there was no law against it. But there are other things that isn't true. And he doesn't find any very, very convincing arguments. And so that raises a different set of issues. But one of the standard arguments for government authority is social contract. And the standard response is, I never signed no social contract. It's a fiction. But the Amish did. Right? That each Amish congregation, every adult in that congregation has signed a social contract. He's promised, he's probably not in writing, but verbally, he's sworn to obey the ordinance of his congregation. So that's the one way of looking at it, is that it's a micro-government with a real social contract. Another way of looking at it is that it's really anarchy, because the rules exist only by unanimous assent, and in an anarchy, after all, people can make contracts. Another way of looking at it is that it's competitive dictatorship, in the sense that the bishop has a lifetime appointment. Now, it's not clear how much of a dictator he is. I think the answer is that in some of the very low affiliations, the bishop gets to make decisions without being vetoed by the members, but in most of the affiliations, the bishop makes decisions, but they have to be unanimously approved by the members, which is also interesting. That is, apparently a conviction has to be unanimously approved, according to stuff I saw, at least in most affiliations, that if the bishop says this person has violated the ordinung and he should be ostracized, that any single member of the congregation can veto that. That they do, I don't know. I mean, obviously there's going to be social pressure to go along, but at least in principle. So one of the interesting questions then is that system going to break down? And I can see a number of mechanisms by which it might break down, though not much evidence that it is. So one case is Lancaster County, because in Lancaster County you have a single affiliation, and you have, I think, twice a year a meeting of all the bishops. And at that meeting, they discuss things like what ought the ordinance to be, what should we do. And although the meeting has no formal authority over the congregation, you could certainly imagine that if all of the sort of older, more respected bishops say you should do something, that the younger bishops might feel under a lot of pressure to go along. So you can imagine that over time evolving into something like a county-level governmental structure in which you've got, as it were, of course, twice a year is also how often the individual congregations get together to do communion and to agree on any changes to the ordinance, so it might fit into that. So that's one potential threat. A different potential threat is associated with the steering committee, because suppose you're on the National Amish Steering Committee, and one of the things you're doing is bargaining with Selective Service. So if an Amish kid's draft board wants to draft him, you're going to Selective Service and say, look, can you persuade them that we're legitimate pacifists and they shouldn't? Another thing you're doing is bargaining over things like school rules. Now, let's suppose that there is a particular congregation which wants to do things that are going to offend the state government. That they want their one-room schoolhouse, I can't think of a good example, but suppose there was an affiliation which disapproved of vaccination. I don't know of any that do, but you could imagine one that did. And suppose you're on the National Amish Steering Committee and you say, you know, if the people in our state get the idea that our people don't get vaccinated, they're going to start worrying, and maybe they're going to start being more restrictive and start insisting on rules on us. We'd better pressure that congregation. Well, how do we pressure the congregation? Well, you know, if one of your kids gets drafted and we don't like you, we might not call the Selective Service. All right, so there is potential, if you think about it, for something like the National Steering Committee to start turning into a government, that it's gone. And its power ultimately comes from the existence of the overgovernment, the fact that it's special, several, the state and federal, but that its job, as it were, is to bargain on behalf of the Amish with that overgovernment. Well, it isn't a legal representative of the Amish. It's not like it's been hired by them, and yet presumably it's got members from many different congregations. It's got a good deal of respect in that community. And it could, as I say, run into problems where individual congregations are doing things that seem problematic from the standpoint of the reputation of the Amish as a whole. Just as one of the points that was made with regard to the gypsies is that the one place where gypsy law restricts gypsy treatment of non-gypsies is that the gypsy treatment of the non-gypsies is going to get other gypsies in trouble. And you could see the same issue arising here. But as far as I know, it hasn't happened. At least I can see no evidence that it has happened. But that's one of the places where you can certainly see the potential. Now, a different question, which intrigues one, again, contrasting the prior to the gypsies, is why they seem to be so successful in dealing with the government. That the gypsies, as far as I can tell, insofar as they get away with things, they get away with things by staying below the radar, by playing games with names and such. The Amish don't. The Amish are, you know, they're out there. They're perfectly public about it. And when the government says that Amish kids have to go to public high schools, the Amish kids go running into a cornfield with news photographers taking pictures of them. And the Amish fathers go to jail. Some of them did for not obeying the compulsory schooling. And eventually the state bends. Which is what actually happens at the state level. Now, eventually it happened at the Supreme Court, but before at the Supreme Court level, you had various states making modifications to their rules in order to accommodate the Amish. So that's sort of interesting, that the Amish, in general, they're not a threat. In general, they're, you know, good citizens. I think they pay taxes other than Social Security taxes, as far as I know. But they are prepared to engage in civil disobedience. They're also prepared to move. I think there was one incident I came across. They didn't actually do it, but where the Amish in some area, I think it was more like, it was like county level, not state level, where the local government authorities were, basically not permitting their schools. They were imposing standards on their schools, which the Amish found unacceptable, and the Amish basically said, well, you know, if necessary, we can all pick up and move to another part of the state. And I think the county eventually moved back down in that one, if I remember correctly, but you can see that. Now, one thing that may help them is they're a tourist attraction. All right, not everywhere, but in Lancaster, my guess is that the non-Amish in Lancaster will be very unhappy to have the Amish disappear. Because what's Lancaster County famous for? It's famous as the center of the Amish, and tourists come to see the Amish. They're also, you know, productive tax-paying citizens. And I think that's also true in Ohio, where I think Ohio, it's either Ohio or Indiana that now has the largest Amish settlement, I think. So, again, the fact that the Amish have good PR, the fact that they are a valuable local asset, in effect, and the fact that they pretty clearly are willing to stand up for themselves. They're not willing to stand up for themselves by fighting people, but they're willing to stand up for themselves by not doing things, by going to jail or by moving. All seems to work pretty well. And so if you compare them to the gypsies, a lot of similarities. The law is oral, although the difference is that the gypsy law is an oral traditional law, so they just say, we know what it is, whereas the Amish, it's really an explicitly agreed upon and steadily changing one. Like the gypsies, they've got what seem to outsiders like very severe restrictions of what they can do, although there's a certain sense in which both sets of restrictions are functional, but the gypsy ones look as though they are functional partly because of superstitious beliefs the gypsies have about purity and impurity, although some of those beliefs may correspond to real issues of disease spreading and such. Like the gypsies, their effective political units are very small. On the other hand, whereas the Vlachram at least have extended families, the Amish seem to have nuclear families. And they get along much better with the host culture. Another difference may be, I'm not entirely sure how gypsies support themselves in modern societies. You know, they have the reputation of being sort of petty thieves and such, whether deserved probably depends on the particular time and place. They do fortune telling. And fortune telling is the sort of thing which, while it may or may not be illegal depending on the state, somehow doesn't feel to the outside culture like it's very productive. It sort of feels like maybe it's a scam, and maybe it is, you don't know. And I'm wondering if part of the difference also is the Amish are perceived as they're hardworking farmers. They're making nice furniture. They're doing useful things. So they have much more the image of being productive members of the society and less the feeling of being sort of parasites or predators or people who are somehow living off the society without contributing to it. So all of those would be relevant. See, I don't know enough about modern gypsies, and I guess there's quite a lot of modern gypsies probably do engage in ordinary productive activities, but I don't think that's the image, and I'm not sure. And it occurs to me that if you think about how they fit into the host culture, that the Amish fit very nicely into our own mythos. If you think of sort of, you know, our vision, think of Little House on the Prairie. All right, very popular series of books about 19th century American frontier culture, series of books. Well, the Amish at least look like they belong in those books, so to speak. Now, the gypsies, it's an interesting case, because if you look, I don't remember if it was in stuff you read, but somewhere in that book on gypsy law, there's a description of the gypsies first showing up, as far as we know, in Western Europe. And they show up at the court of the Holy Roman Emperor, and they've got a cover story that fits into the existing culture. Because their cover story is that they are from Little Egypt in Greece, that their ancestors abandoned Christianity, that they then repented, and that the penance that they are doing for their ancestors' sin is going on pilgrimage through Europe, essentially. So they have a cover story which fits into, as it were, the mythos of the host society, and that may explain what I did fairly well. I think that's much less true, say, in the 19th or 20th century. Any more things people would like to say about the gypsies? About the Amish.
I was confused when you said the first way of my breakdown was,
oh, I was only saying that since they both have communion twice a year and the Council of Bishops meets twice a year, you can imagine if the Council of Bishops is in the process of turning itself into a sort of a de facto government, well, we're going to meet now. Next week, you're going to say to your congregation, here's what has been decided about the changes in the ordinance. I was just thinking that in that sense, it could fit in. But I don't, as far as I know, all that's happening so far is only the kind of social pressure that consists of, well, an older and wiser bishop said that they should change it, so maybe we should. Now, of course, there's also potentially a kind of social pressure, which is that being in one affiliation depends on having ordnungen that aren't too different from each other. So you could certainly imagine a case where most of the congregations in the affiliation change in some way, and after a while they go to the holdout and say, look, you don't really belong in our affiliation anymore because we've decided you can do X, Y, and Z, and you say you can't. And again, I don't know that that's actually happened. Although obviously I assume that the existing set of affiliations partly reflect past splits of various sorts. And there have been occasional sort of fairly visible splits where some of which produce not quite Amish. As I think I commented in the chapter, exactly where you draw the line of what either is Amish isn't at all clear, because there are groups such as the Beachy Amish are one of them, which are split offs from the Amish in the direction of being substantially less restricted. And the term tends to be used, old order Amish is what I'm calling Amish. And but I don't think any of the other groups are very large. My impression, at least, is that the old order Amish have been more successful than the split-off groups, and I think that the split-off groups have tended to then lose their people to Mennonites and to still less. One comment that was made, and I remember if I'm making the chapter or not in one of my sources, is that the lower groups are less tolerant of their people sort of doing things, less tolerant of people leaving the lower groups have a lower rate of defection, but that their defectors go farther. That is to say that the higher groups, when people defect, they become Mennonites. The lower groups, a smaller percentage of their kids stop being Amish, but when they do, they go into the general society rather than, so that they're sort of pushing, I guess that you've got to really not like it in order to leave, and if you really don't like it, maybe you don't want to be a Mennonite either. That was the impression. All right. I thought if we finish talking about the Amish, that I would talk a little bit about Jewish law, since I've really probably not allowed enough time for doing that one this year. I'm not sure why I did that in the syllabus, but I think we'll probably try to stick with it as it is. I may end up shifting the syllabus a little bit. But I thought I could spend the last bit of today sort of introducing some stuff on Jewish law. One of the things that I find really interesting about Jewish law is that it survives as a legal system for nearly 2,000 years after the Kingdom of Israel is more or less ground to dust by the Romans. So that you have something that starts out associated with a state, and yet survives without that state. And in theory, what Jewish law is based on is the Torah, which is, I think the first seven books of the Old Testament, if I've got it right, the Septuagint, sometimes called. And the Torah actually has quite a lot of law in it, a good deal more, I think, than the Quran does. The next source after that that we have, as you've got clearly over a period of time, legal scholars who are, just as in the Islamic case, discussing, given this is what the Torah says, what does it tell us the law should be? But the first written source we've got on that is the Mishnah, which is about 200 A.D., and the Mishnah is basically a compilation of rabbinic law. However, one of its features is that it is not very clear about what the law is. That is to say, the Mishnah may very well say, scholar so-and-so, rabbi so-and-so said that, but rabbi so-and-so said. And part of what's going on there is that you have a division among the legal scholars between what was called the school of Hillel and the school of Shammai, where these are schools of thought. They're like the Islamic legal schools, where they disagreed on various details of the law. And the story, at least as you see it, is that for about four generations, they, like the Muslims, regarded each other as mutually orthodox. That the way it was put was they were willing to eat in each other's houses and marry each other's daughters, even though their detailed interpretation of things like kosher rules and such wasn't identical. But eventually that breaks down, and what I think happens is that the majority school, which is the school of Hillel, effectively suppresses the school of Shammai. And there's a story, which I think I have in the Jewish chapter, and if I don't, I'll have to tell you, because it's a wonderful story, called the story of the oven of Achnai, which is, I think, in part a story about that process, about eventually the majority deciding not to tolerate the minority. And part of what's going on here, one of the issues we'll be discussing, is how in a divinely inspired system do you get agreement? And the basic way that they do it initially is that there is a body called the Sanhedrin, which is sort of like a Supreme Court, except it's bigger than the Supreme Court, but it's the collection of sort of official judges. And the view is that where judges, where legal scholars disagree about the law, once the Sanhedrin has voted and a majority have decided on one interpretation of the law, that the minority can continue to argue for their position, but they cannot judge according to it. So that the view essentially is that truth is not determined by majority vote, but law is determined by majority vote. And thus what you end up with in the Oven of Achnai story is somebody who I think is the leading scholar of the school of Shammai being in effect excommunicated. But as you'll see, it's a very odd story because it's not at all clear whether God does or doesn't approve of all of this in the story. Yep.
Now, to what extent is the Old Testament and the Torah linked?
What?
The Old Testament, like, if you have a Bible, it has the Old Testament in it.
Yeah.
And it seems like there's a lot of, like, especially in, like, Leviticus, there's a lot of rules.
Yes.
And now, are Jews governed by those rules?
That's a very complicated question. The answer is, in theory, yes, but in practice, no. That the way I like to put it is that the Torah contains one phrase which translates as, you were to add nothing to these laws. Another phrase that translates as, you were to subtract nothing from these laws. And rabbinic law has about six or eight different Hebrew phrases, each of which is the name of one way or another of adding to or subtracting from the law. And the sort of, well, I'll give you a number of examples. It's an interesting general issue. It starts with my very favorite get out of jail free card, which is the doctrine of the oral Torah.
And the doctrine of the oral Torah is that in addition to Moses giving the written Torah handed down to him by God, he also passed on to his successors a oral Torah, a set of unwritten instructions. And therefore, legal scholars in interpreting the written Torah can at least claim that this is in a tradition from Moses that tells us how to interpret it. And there are at least some cases where the rabbinic law is pretty clearly inconsistent with the written Torah. There's one detail of inheritance, which I now forget, where there's a specific law of the sequence of the priority, and the rabbinic law at one point goes in a different direction. But let me give you a couple of examples of both expanding and contracting. One of them is that, as you may know, one of the rules of kosher law, of kosher rules, is that you're not to eat meat and milk of the same meal. What the Torah says is you're not to eat a kid stewed in his mother's milk. That's all it says. And the term used for this kind of expansion is a fence around the law, or a fence around the Torah. So the argument in this case and a variety of others is we are making more stricter rules than we're actually required to. Because if we let people go just up to the limits of what's forbidden, then some of them are going to go over it. And therefore we're pushing it further away. So that's an example of something where you're getting a stricter rule than the Torah gives you, adding something to the law. But then in the other direction, and I guess my favorite example probably, is the question of the disobedient son. Because Torah says that if the son is disobedient, his mother and father are supposed to take him to the communal authorities and have him stoned to death. And you then read what the legal scholars say. What the legal scholars say, well, yes, it's true that Torah says this, but from this bit of the passage, we can deduce that it only applies if, I think I may actually in the chapter give the whole list or part of the list from Maimonides, which I don't think he originated, but that he has to, I don't remember, I think the original actually is being a glutton, and so they're defining he's got to eat meat, and I no longer remember the law, but it's a long list of things, of precise things he's got to do. Furthermore, some people say that the mother and father must have identical voices because the original passage is supposed to say they are supposed to say to the communal authorities our son is. And then there's a question of what counts as a son. And there's a passage, I think it's in Maimonides, and again, this may not be original with him, in which they say, well, if he's less than 13, I guess, then he's a child and not responsible for himself. And if he's 13, and it's either a quarter or a half, he's may have been through puberty, and so he might have had sex with a woman and get her pregnant. In which case, in another 3 months, it might be known that she's pregnant. Well, if he's sired a child, he's not a son anymore, he's a father, so therefore it doesn't apply to him. So therefore, it's only between, I think it's 13 and 13 and a half, if I remember correctly, that argument that this rule can apply. So you just go through piling on more and more requirements, and you end up with the conclusion it's never happened. Explicitly, the legal scholars say that even though the Torah says this, there has never been a case where it has been proper to stone a disobedient son. So you get a lot of stuff of that sort, where they don't like the rule and are working around it. There's a different one, which is particularly interesting to economists, and that is that you're supposed to have forgiveness of debts every 7 years in the Torah. And there's an obvious problem with forgiveness of debts every 7 years, and it's a problem which the author of the Torah recognized, which is that then people on the sixth year aren't willing to lend anything to anybody because they know they'll never get it back. And the Torah says, I don't know how it's put it, but basically you shouldn't be stingy and refuse to lend to a needy neighbor in the sixth year, even though. But then various of the legal scholars, and I think in fact that Hillel is credited with it, though I'm not sure, invent a legal form called prospul, in which, in effect, if I've got it right, in the sixth year, I think, you sort of commend the debt to the care of the court, and then the court gives it back to you after the seventh year. And that probably isn't the correct description, but it's a legal form which allows you to create a debt that will not be canceled in the seventh year, as all debts are supposed to be canceled. So that would be another example where you're doing the same thing. And then there are a variety of other outs. There's the argument which basically says we shouldn't break anything in the Torah, but our people have to survive. and therefore that you can temporarily abrogate any of the laws if doing so is really essential. And just as I'm pretty sure that at least some Muslims would hold that you could eat forbidden meat if you would starve to death otherwise. And various religions, I think there's one of the issues among Shia and Sunni, is whether Shia are entitled by their own rules to pretend they're Sunni if they're going to get killed by the Sunni if they don't, essentially. And I think, though I'm not sure that they are. So it's not all that uncommon, you know, sort of the outsiders to see these as absolute rules, whereas the people in it say, yeah, we're reasonable people, and if obeying the rule gets you into enough trouble, then God doesn't want you to obey the rule. So in that sense, you on the one hand have a set of divinely inspired rules, but on the other hand, you've got quite a lot of ways in which they get changed. And you've got essentially a tradition of rabbinic law, which is the legal scholars saying what they think the rules are, with theoretically some, I think they almost always have some connection to Torah in the arguments for the rules, but they may not be at all obviously what the Torah is actually saying. Let me, another few minutes, just give you a little bit more background. So you've got Torah, you've then got the Mishnah, you then have the Talmud. There are really two Talmuds, the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud. But the Jerusalem Talmud, I think, was unfinished, and the Babylonian Talmud is what we usually mean by the Talmud. And what these are the output of arguments over the law in the Babylonian academies, where there were lots of Jewish legal scholars. And the Talmud, in effect, is the Mishnah, surrounded by a whole lot of argument about what these passages of the Mishnah mean, plus a lot of other material of stories and things of this sort that go along with it. And I think I have a link somewhere in something that you're supposed to read to a blog post I had discussing basically how frustrating both the Talmud and the Mishnah are compared to my third source, which is Maimonides. And Maimonides is really only one example that you've basically got in the post-Talmud, in Talmudic law. It looks as though every couple of hundred years, there's some really brilliant legal scholar who writes a great treatise. And for a while, the judges who are deciding things say, all right, this is the best summary of the law that now exists. We're going to use this to decide what it is. And then some other great scholar writes a treatise, and sometimes it may be that the French communities... Remember that I'm talking now about the diaspora, about a point when Israel no longer exists as a kingdom and when the Jewish population is scattered through Christian and Muslim lands, essentially, but frequently self-ruling. That is, with the local ruler having said, all right, the Jewish communal authorities can run their own affairs as long as they pay taxes and aren't any problem. So it might be that one authority would be the one who was mostly accepted in France and Germany, and another one was mostly accepted in Spain and North Africa, say, might be a division. And Maimonides is one of these scholars. And one of the things distinctive about his work compared to some but not all of the others is that to each question he gives only one answer. So that whereas the Mishnah will say, Hillel said this and Shammai said this, Maimonides normally will say this. It is black letter law, so to speak, except it's not official black letter law. It's black letter law is deduced by a scholar who had a very high reputation. And part of what the sequence, basically, we ask, how do you settle disputes? And the answer in the early period is the Sanhedrin gets to decide disputes. And the Sanhedrin survives a bit longer than the Kingdom of Israel does, but it eventually goes away. And then for a while, you've got a sort of a de facto decision by the Babylonian academies, that the heads of the Babylonian academies are thought of as the most learned authorities. So if you're a judge in the diaspora and you have a hard case, you write up the case, you send it to the head of one of the Babylonian academies, a year later you get a letter back from him saying the right answer to this is such and such, and then that's the way you rule thereafter. And these are what are called responsa, and they're part of our source, that is, are these written descriptions, of which there are several hundred thousand surviving. So you really are talking about a very, very well-documented system. But after a while, the Babylonian academies sort of lose their status. And from then on, it really is a matter of
the reputation of the individual scholars. Do you follow Maimonides? Do you follow someone else? And so forth. And yet, the impression one gets is that at any given time, law didn't vary that much across the diaspora, that it wasn't entirely uniform, but it was pretty uniform. All right, I think we're about out of time. So you can read the stuff and we can discuss more of it next time. And as you will see, part of your reading is reading a noticeable chunk of Maimonides, but you get to pick which piece out of three different books you want to read, a short chunk of the Mishnah, and a still shorter chunk of the Talmud, just so you can see what those things look like.